Behind the Lines.
Inside the Newsroom. From Guardian Australia.
Hi, I'm Gabrielle Jackson. Today on Behind the Lines, we're presenting a talk between The Guardian's Editor-in-Chief, Catherine Viner, Lenore Taylor, Guardian Australia's Editor-in-Chief, and the ABC's Mark Colvin. It was a really interesting discussion about the threats facing public interest journalism, social media, fake news, and finding new sources of funding. The event was recorded live in Sydney, and we provided priority access to Guardian members to thank them for their support. If you're a member, thank you so much for standing with us. This week, we reached a really important milestone. We now have 200,000 members globally, and this will help offset some of the decline in digital advertising. But we still need more support. You can help us by becoming a member. Visit theguardian.com/au for more details. We don't have shareholders. We don't have a multi-millionaire media mogul owner. So all the contributions we receive go directly to supporting our editorial operations. Now, let's get to it. Here's the podcast. Lenore Taylor starts the talk speaking about the threats to our understanding of the truth.
Is everyone here? Thanks, everyone, for coming tonight. I'm Lenore Taylor, editor of Guardian Australia, and I hope you're going to enjoy this event or discussion. About four months before the US presidential election, I should say, our global editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner, wrote an essay called How Technology Disrupted the Truth. And certainly for me, and I think for a lot of people who read it, it pulled together a whole lot of issues that I'd been thinking about the links between the upheavals in the way politics was working around the world, the huge disruption that we're facing every day in the business model for the media, and the way that those issues were linked together by social media and our understanding of the truth. And what that essay crystallised back then, I think now has become really front of mind around the world as we watch Donald Trump's presidency unfold and see how he sort of deems anyone who disagrees with him as being fake. So we wanted to kind of flesh out those issues tonight in this conversation. And we always love having Catherine in Australia because she was actually the launch editor of Guardian Australia. She seemed to... She seemed at the time to get to know, you know, half of Australia in a matter of months, and she had this enormous drive and energy which really got our organisation going. She got across all these technical Australian political terms like spill really, really quickly. She actually needed to because there are a couple of those. And I think, you know, we have to thank Catherine a lot for the fact that we actually got up and running. We're also really delighted to have Mark Colvin here tonight. He's rushed over from hosting PM and he will have a wealth of insights and understanding to bring to the conversation. So we're going to hear from Catherine, then Mark will and Catherine and I will have a conversation about these issues, and then we're going to open things up to you for your thoughts and your questions. There are going to be some little cards going around if you'd like to write a question down that can be brought up, and Mark can sort of facilitate that into the conversation. Or later on, there'll also be some roving microphones as well. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Catherine.
Thanks very much for coming. I do love coming to Sydney. It's true. I had such a wonderful time during those heady launch days. I can now confess that we're only about six of us producing it at the time, but it looked like a proper website, and now it really is one.
And one of them's now retreated to a monastery, by the way.
And worse. So, it was a truly exciting thing to do, to launch The Guardian here and to work so closely with Lenore. And I know there's lots of members in the room, Guardian supporters, and the success of membership and contributions around the world, in fact, especially in Australia, proportionately more than anywhere else, has been very heartening. And we know that there are many people around the world who value Guardian journalism. So we're here tonight to discuss if the truth still matters. And the reason I think we're asking that question is driven by technology. So the technological revolution has changed everything from how we travel to how we bank to how we find someone to love to politics. And there's been a big fallout from all of that. And when it comes to the news, the fallout threatens the free press and democracy and the truth. So to kick off the session today, I'd like to talk just briefly about how this undermining of the truth is taking place, with some examples of the new challenges and dilemmas that we now face. Of course, the truth is notoriously difficult to define. One man's truth is another man's lies, and pinning down what really happened in any event is hard. Memory is unreliable, vision can be blurry, our emotions and psychological makeup and perspective and physical situation can get in the way. But facts exist, and the aim of good journalism is to find them, whatever they may be. Truth may be hard to find, but the endeavour to uncover it, the endeavour to risk uncovering facts which might undermine your worldview, or facts certainly that someone somewhere doesn't want you to know, is worth the work. So we mustn't give up the fight for them, but there are several reasons why they're under attack. The main one, in my view, is the economics of the internet. The business model for digital is based on clicks rather than quality. You get more money from advertisers for the more clicks you get. It no longer seems to matter to companies what content their ads appear beside. From this, conventional news organisations have fallen into the trap of publishing clickbait, cheap material that doesn't serve their audience and doesn't serve society, but serves the click economy of the internet. This means that stories might not be checked, sources might not be found, and false stories can spread like wildfire. This economics of the internet has also led to the establishment of a new business, and that's fake news farms. These are places where people literally just sit at their keyboards making things up. They invent stories that are as extreme and as shocking as possible because they're more likely to get more clicks. There's a famous click farm in Macedonia, which invented a huge number of pro-Trump news stories, including the massive scoop that the Pope, the social justice-loving Pope, the environmentalist Pope, had come out for Trump. Got lots of readership, lots of clicks, and it's perhaps no surprise that these fake news farms are profitable businesses. This is unlike real journalism, which takes labour. The best kind takes a lot of labour. And time and research and what might come up with a less electrifying newsline and which doesn't make money, because all the advertising money that used to go to news organisations is now going to Google and Facebook instead. Advertising, which has helped fund news organisations fund The Guardian for nearly 200 years, is moving away from them at a dramatic pace. Google and Facebook now take the almost unbelievable sum of 99 cents of every new dollar of advertising money in the US. So they take all of it. An interesting aside is that some people thought the internet would democratize publishing. In fact, it has put the power into the hands of the very few, into the hands of the two, Facebook and Google, without any of the accountability and responsibility of the old gatekeepers. The link to this is the business model of Facebook. Facebook is so enormously profitable because it is a gigantic store of the personal data of 1.7 billion people around the world. Every time you perform any action on Facebook, just liking something, you are doing their work for them by feeding their algorithm that makes their profits. This works by leveraging the closeness of our relationships with family and friends, as hosted by Facebook. And leads us to the second main cause of the challenge to the truth, which is filter bubbles. We now spend a lot of our time in echo chambers, hearing views the same as our own, reinforcing our perspectives, driving ourselves deeper in. We're rarely challenged, we rarely hear a different point of view. In the Brexit referendum in the UK, Tom Steinberg, internet entrepreneur, he put out a plea on Facebook to try to find someone who was voting Leave. I mean, more people voted Leave than Remain, but he couldn't find anyone who voted Leave in his face. He tried in Facebook. He just couldn't find them because his filter bubbles were so strong, the echo chambers were so solid that he couldn't get out of it as hard as he tried. There's an interesting statistic which I feel is linked to that, which is that Republicans marrying Democrats has gone down in the US. The third aspect is that on the internet, all stories look the same. a story from a trusted news source like The Guardian, and a story from a Macedonian fake news farm that are given equal status in your Facebook feed. It can be hard to differentiate, even when you work in the news. So fake news is a symptom of how social media is rewiring how people receive, debate, and act on information. And in light of that, it's perhaps not surprising that citizens are finding that facts are increasingly becoming that which you feel to be true. The information we're receiving is so confusing, so overwhelming. The sourcing is so opaque. The amount of it is so shocking that it's very difficult to know what you should trust. If you add into that the greater cultural and financial polarization that's happening in society, and perhaps you'd add in the physical fear instilled by terrorism and the existential fear instilled by climate change, I don't think it's a surprise that what appear to be facts are not necessarily to be trusted. There's a Pankaj Mishra in his new book, he puts it like this: in the face of unintelligible disasters, feelings and hunches seem more reliable. Populists have successfully exploited this moment for political ends. Aaron Banks, who funded the far-right Leave.eu bit of the Brexit referendum campaign, said they took an American-style approach. What we said early on was that facts don't work and that's it. The Remain campaign featured fact, fact, fact. It just doesn't work. You have to connect with people emotionally. There followed from that Kellyanne Conway and her alternative facts and her Bowling Green massacre, and Pizzagate, an alt-right conspiracy theory involving Hillary Clinton and a child sex ring and John Podesta and a pizza restaurant that led to a man with a gun going and threatening, shooting up a pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C. It led to Trump's bizarre remarks this week about what happened in Sweden, and his use of the term fake news to attack any story he dislikes, any source he dislikes, much copied by politicians all over the world. Trump has set a new challenge for the media. He lies so often and so blatantly in a way that is so easy to disprove. So should the media fact check every lie? Or is that a waste of rare reporting resource when we should be just finding out what he's actually doing? But if you don't investigate every lie and refute them with evidence, are you letting the lies stand? But if you do, are you letting him set the agenda entirely? And how should you respond to the demeaning and hate-filled attacks on social media that have become a factor of so many people's lives, these attempts to undermine those pursuing journalism in the public interest? And Trump, of course, shows no commitment to a free press. Last week, he described it as an enemy of the American people. This era has brought another issue, which is conventional news organisations reporting stories that they're not sure are true. The Daily Mail did it with the distasteful story of a youthful David Cameron. He said he'd put his genitals into the mouth of a dead pig at an exclusive dinner. I bet that's not been said in this room before. A few hours after publication, the author of the story admitted on TV that she didn't know if it was true or not. It was up to the readers to decide. Just a few weeks ago, we had the challenge of the so-called dirty dossier containing compromising material on Trump involving links to Russia and prostitution. Several news organisations had the dossier, including The Guardian, and we were trying to verify the information in it, which was proving difficult, and it decided not to publish it unless we could prove it was true. But BuzzFeed published all of it, using the same reasoning that the Cameron Piggate reporter used. Americans can make up their own minds. But if expert journalistic sleuthing can't work out what's true and what isn't, why would an ordinary citizen, unless we're conceding that a fact is just what feels to be true? There are new challenges to the truth advancing every moment. The campaigns for Trump and Brexit both use psychometric targeting tools, which means that every voter got a different message based on their personality, which is based on what they've liked on Facebook. Because these unique messages are not visible to anyone except the individual, lies can easily be shared this way with no checks and balances or accountability. But the development I consider most dystopian is the new voice software, which needs just 20 minutes of voice samples from a given speaker. From that, it can then invent entirely new recordings of your voice saying absolutely anything. The potential for that is terrifying. Journalism exists to hold the powerful to account in a democracy. It's for strengthening public bonds and creating an informed public to get the good information that they need to build a good society. I think that's really hard to do at the moment. I think it's more important than ever that we have a media you can trust that's genuinely committed to the public interest instead of for commercial gain or for political influence. Reporting is more important than ever. Serious, fact-based, boots on the ground, finding out what's really happening. Alternative ownership models, such as The Guardian's, in which there are no shareholders and no proprietor, and all money is ploughed into the journalism, matter more than ever. And membership and reader contributions matter ever so much. And we're very grateful to all the members here tonight.
Good, well, there's a lot there to start to talk about. Why don't we start with an individual incident and kind of work out from there, one that you mentioned, the dirty dossier. Christopher Steele, we now know, former officer in the same service that my father worked in, as it happens, MI6, SIS. He was, by all accounts, a very highly regarded Russia expert. But then on the flip side, the dossier itself was what in intelligence circles is regarded as raw intelligence, hadn't been processed, nobody had done what we think of as an editorial process on it. So lots of it was unverified. Now, subsequent reports in reliable organisations have suggested that some of it was true. Now, you decided not to run it, and that's an absolutely tenable position. But the question that I'm going to ask you is, at what stage would you have run any of it or all of it?
I think at any point we could have verified something within it that made a story of its own.
So you had it and you had reporters?
Yeah.
I mean, Luke Harding or somebody working on it, did you?
Yeah.
And he was starting to go through.
It was reporters in the US who had it, yeah.
Right.
Quite a few news organisations had it.
Yeah. I know. But just take us through for people who are not in our business.
Yes.
Take us through the process of what you do in that situation.
To try and check it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very hard because a lot of spy-like material is, it's sort of rumours, isn't it? I mean, that's what spying is. It's gathering of gossip and rumour and trying to piece together information that way. And I think that's such a long way from what you can prove that we were finding it very difficult. I mean, we weren't getting that far with it at that point.
Now, when BuzzFeed publishes the whole thing, what do you do then?
Well, BuzzFeed published it in full and without. I mean, one of the things I've wondered, because I think we made the right decision not to publish what we couldn't verify. But obviously, I think, you know, things are changing. Times are changing. I want to be sure that doesn't become an anachronistic point of view. Mm. You know, I feel committed to the facts, but I just, there's 1% of me want to make sure that we don't. And I wonder if a better way to have done it would be to publish it with annotations right there so that you could say, this is unverified, this is unverified, this seems unlikely to be true, this is definitely not true because some of it was provably not true and so on. I wonder if that might have been a better technique. But what we did on the day was we linked to it.
Right. And we can go back a little bit in time to the point when somebody was shopping around a DVD of a disc of, or series of discs of MPs' expenses, and it was shopped right around Fleet Street, and eventually it was rejected by a lot of newspapers. I don't know if The Guardian was among them.
Yes, I don't know.
But it was eventually published by The Telegraph, I think.
They bought it.
Yeah. So, what would you have done in those circumstances?
I don't know what it looked like at the time. You know, I don't know what they were presented with.
Yeah.
And it's it, we
wouldn't pay for that information.
Right.
But it was an amazing story.
The checkbook journalism side comes in for you at that point.
Yeah.
But it certainly it was the story of the year, really, wasn't it? It was an absolute...
For years, and the reverberations are being felt now, and I think that the way that politicians in Britain are treated with contempt a lot of the time, a lot of it stems from that period.
People still think about duck houses.
It's always the duck house, isn't it? You know, what's interesting...
And the moat.
No, what's interesting about MPs' expenses is that if the, some people ripped off a really huge amount of money, but people don't remember those. People remember the guy who claimed 1p for a paper bag or something. You know, they and the duck house, and they remember the preposterous. So the tip when ripping off the state is always to make sure you don't do anything.
You do something rather prosaic.
Rather prosaic, yeah. Flip your mortgage or something.
So, has anything about the Steele dossier changed the way you think about how you'll act in the future?
I think probably not, but I think we should stay alert to changes in how, you know, news appears. I do.
Right, and do you think that suppose there were a dossier which was not raw intelligence, which had been had gone up the chain and had been rather clearly vetted, and it showed that the Trump organization had been in bed with some very dodgy people. This is the worst question in a way, because I think myself that the answer is probably no. Would it have changed anything?
Changed anything
in the election?
If it had been published and there
yeah,
was...
if it had been if it had happened in the lead up to November the 8th.
I think it wouldn't have done, because that's not why Trump was elected, was it? It wasn't anything to do with those things. It was how people felt. I think it was a coalition of reasons, but one of them was that how people felt ignored and discarded and left behind, and that's nothing to do with what was in the dirty dossier. Has nothing to do with that. And then you throw in some racists, and you know, you throw in some old Republicans, and you end up with 52%.
So
no, that's not right. That was Brexit.
Yeah,
so I've got a bit of jet lag.
So that brings us back to facts versus feelings, yes. Which is what you were talking about. And that takes us to Facebook. The personal declaration, I left Facebook several years ago for precisely these reasons.
Really?
Because I just kept noticing how Facebook changed its privacy settings all the time. Mm. And there was always a way to get around it and to protect your privacy a bit more. But it was always very, very complicated, and it wasn't very well signposted. You didn't know when they changed the privacy settings, and it looked to me like a metadata farm. It looked to me like exactly what you've been talking about, which is...
Have you ever written about that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, time might be now.
So what do you do? I mean, given that every... Actually, this is a really good example. If somebody is on Facebook and they're regularly liking and reposting Guardian articles, people in political parties, in large companies, whatever, are going to make assumptions about their politics.
Yeah.
So what is your relationship with Facebook? How do you handle it?
It's a complicated relationship, I'd say. Because on the one hand, you know, the Guardian
when
is now...
say it's complicated.
Yeah. That's what, yeah,
it's never good.
I mean, because of Facebook and Google, The Guardian is now the third most read English language newspaper website in the world, sometimes second, all behind Mail Online, of course. And, you know, that we've got 158 million browsers worldwide. We've got this gigantic reach all over the world, and that's because of Facebook and Google. So, you know... So in one way, Facebook have been this amazing thing for The Guardian. But in other, I think what you're describing there, though, is more of a challenge to citizens. You know, if they spent all night liking and sharing on Facebook, they've spent all night working for Facebook, you know, feeding their algorithm, giving the money they need to make profits, but they're working for free, you know.
That's true. But how do you... Is there anything that you can do to influence, given that they must rely on you to a degree, and and that enormous reach isn't necessarily turning up as cash in the Guardian's bank account.
Not at all.
Can you do to influence Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah, I mean, not that much. I mean, he's just sort of. I'm not sure how crucial news organisations are to him. I think, I think it's just about content. It's not about good content, factual content, true content. It's just content.
We'll come back to him in a minute. But, Lenora, I didn't mean to leave you out for so long.
Fine. Fascinating.
What's your analysis of how the whole fake news phenomenon is affecting Australia? And are we different in any way because, for instance, we have compulsory voting? Are things different because of that?
I do think compulsory preferential voting means that the potential impact, like the ultimate effect, is mitigated. But I don't think we're immune from the phenomenon. I mean, as a political reporter for a long time, I kept feeling like the facts were sort of untethering and floating up, and it was sort of increasingly hard to nail them down. And political debate, it seemed to not matter anymore whether it was based on facts or not. And in particular, in the reporting of climate change. So, we've had a debate for more than a decade, which if facts had been dictating the debate, it would have gone really quite differently, right? Like, I mean, it's kind of a bit unhinged and has been for a long time. And so I think it's not as pronounced here. We haven't got a character like Donald Trump who's as sort of brazen in his assault on facts and factual debate. But I think we're headed in the same direction. We've seen the same phenomenon in a sort of watered down form, for sure.
How much does a vigorous media affect all that? I mean, thinking of facts. Facts went overboard and the children overboard of the fair, and then probably one of the most influential bits of video was when Virginia Trioli just dissected Peter Reith on that question.
Yeah.
And we have and in Britain too, I saw an interview that Jon Snow did with Carter Page, who's Trump's foreign policy advisor, a couple of days ago. Jon Snow is the presenter at Channel 4, and he just dug his teeth into his leg and wouldn't let him go. You know, it's that. We do have that tradition still in parts of our media, and it is different from what we see with the very deferential White House correspondence. Do you think that's important?
Yeah, of course it's important. It's critically important. But there's always this concern as people get their news in filter bubbles, as people become disengaged, that it will be less important, that it will have less influence. And I think we have to constantly think about who we're talking to and who we're listening to. So, The Guardian has a readership and we listen to those readers. We have methods of hearing and seeing what they think and what they want to read about. But there's a whole thing happening in Australian politics, evidenced by the recent polling results of Pauline Hanson, which is an entirely different phenomenon, and we need to think about how do we listen to the views of those people? How do we know what's motivating them? We can't just kind of yell, that's terrible, those views don't make any sense. We need to find a way of knowing where they're coming from, why they're thinking about that way. And I think we need to also not accept the analysis from some other publications about what's motivating them, that it's all because, the political elites are concentrating on sort of certain sort of politically correct ideas and that makes a certain part of the electorate, feel disengaged. Perhaps it's actually very good economic reasons and very good reasons in their own lives that they're feeling disengaged. So our challenge is to find the resources and to find the wherewithal to go out and actually understand what that is about, to not go out and sort of dictate from on high and to not sort of talk about people but to actually listen to them. I think it's really important.
But and in a sense, this is a rerun for us because through the 90s, Pauline Hanson was on the rise. She was taken on in different ways. She was taken on by the media, often very aggressively. And every time that happened, she seemed to gain from it. Is there a lesson to be learned from that?
Well, I think the most interesting thing that's happening is the way that this bending of the truth is actually being used to change where we draw the parameters or the acceptable parameters of political debate. So, you know, you can have people you disagree with, you agree with, but back then being overtly racist was considered in a bipartisan manner to be outside the realm of what was acceptable debate. That's not the case anymore. We're hearing these arguments all the time that somehow equate Pauline Hanson's actually racist views about Islam with what the Greens say about how the state of Israel, you know, how policy should react to the state of Israel and the treatment of Palestine. Now, whatever your views are about the Israel-Palestinian question, those two things aren't really equivalent. They're not the same. But there's excuses being used again and again to try and justify preference deals with Pauline Hanson, which have the effect of legitimising views that used to be considered illegitimate.
What about fact-checking?
So I think fact-checking has a role in all of this, but I also think human stories have a role in all of this, that people often... Let's think about the 2013 budget. If we just fact-checked the 2013 budget, perhaps that wouldn't have had such an impact. But if we... But we and many people wrote about the 2013 budget as it would impact on real people's lives and the lives of unemployed or students or, and that those human stories that when you relate it to people's experiences, when you get people to tell you stories, that sometimes has combined with fact checking a much more powerful impact, I think.
Taking it back to America and to Britain. One of the effects of fact-checking, one of the effects of this bubble seems to be that people have decided that the fact-checking organisations are themselves partisan. Oh, PolitiFact, you can dismiss that. Or yes. Snopes, which has been around for ages, yes. Just carefully checking. They're well-known, and sometimes they're accused of being well-known left and right wingers in the same Twitter thread.
They're just alternative facts, Mark.
Yeah. So, how do we get around that?
I think this is the big challenge of the times, I think. I think we have to be careful about too much fact-checking because it suggests that if it isn't in a fact-checking area, then it's not factual. Whereas, you know, everything we publish should be factual. And so sort of to say, oh, that's the fact-check bit, and the rest, I don't know, you know, that's not, doesn't instill much trust.
Yeah. What's your position on lies, on the word
lies? I'm against them. Oh, no.
On the word lies.
Definitely.
We're all against them. Even us in the Lügen Presse, which was Hitler's word for the lying press, and emerged again during the Trump campaign. Disgusting. We are all against lies, but what do you think of the use of the word lies? It's come up because The New York Times has started occasionally using it. John Rentoul, who you would know, who's the political editor, I think, of The Independent, wrote a rather eloquent column saying that you shouldn't use the word lie unless you've got some sort of telepathic window into somebody's head.
It's about motivation.
Intention is, exactly. Where do you stand?
On the actual word?
It's, as an editor, it's clearly in your purview.
I think one of the problems with Trump is that if you use it every time, you'd overuse it. You know, you'd just use it. Yeah. You could use it in 10 headlines a day, and so it would lose its power. But it's an interesting idea about intention. I'm not sure whether that matters, does it?
I think with the word lie, it does. I think
you wouldn't use it.
I would use the word untruth, yeah. Falsehood. In Trump's case, sometimes delusion. I mean, because I think there are... I know it sounds like I'm joking, but I think there is evidence that there have been untruths that he has told repeatedly and he has been faced with the facts and he still chooses to believe it. He came pretty close to that in the press conference when, as you know, he was challenged about the 306 being the highest number of electoral votes ever. He didn't quite say, well, I still believe it, but he said, well, I was told it and, you know, somebody told me it, and he clearly did. He still was hanging on to that fact, and I think that gets close to a delusion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think lie has an element of intent, and falsehood or untruth is something that's demonstrably untrue but possibly not intentionally said as such.
You just say this isn't true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Anyway, that's so. I mean, the fact that we have to talk about that is about as indicative of what the situation is as it could be. I'm going to bring you back to the Facebook situation. There was a story last year. I read a column last year by somebody who had been employed by Facebook as part of a team of editors, which had been deliberately set up in order to try and break down some of this bubble or silo effect within Facebook. And then they were all sacked and replaced with an algorithm.
With dramatic effects.
With dramatic, really, really dramatic effects. And it happened in the middle of the year.
Yeah.
And it had the effect of intensifying the really dreadful polarization of the electorate. So again, you're one news organization, the New York Times is another, the Washington Post, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of big organizations that are lining Mark Zuckerberg's pocket. Is there anything that you can do to get together, given that he seems to be toying with a political career himself? Allegedly, you know, there have been some
stories. If he wants to do a political career, he's certainly got all the data on all of us that
exactly
he'll need to target. I think
and
he would
we'll
do rather
on to
well.
That in a second.
Okay.
But the, you know, he has shown signs of wanting to at least look as if he's more socially responsible. Do you think that anything can be done with that?
Well, he certainly he raised a few of those things last week in the letter and. But as you say, you know, you almost want the, you want the behaviour, not the words. So that algorithm change dramatically increased the visibility of fake news and who knows if they're lies, untruths, just myths, conspiracy theories. It did that dramatically, you know, you could easily build an algorithm that prioritised quality, and he doesn't do that. So I mean, at least he sort of knows there's a problem. But, you know, perhaps he could get Peter Thiel off the Facebook board. I don't know. He needs to show us a few things.
Yeah. So, as you say, he if he did run, he'd have all the data on us. And the power of that, I was telling Lenore this story. I told it to you in a slightly more lurid way than the reality. My memory was a little exaggerated, but it's a great story. It comes from an article by Charles Duhigg, who wrote a book about privacy, and it was a 2012 article in the New York Times. And it's about the chain store Target, which isn't the same as Target in this country. I think it's a different corporation, but it's huge. It's like Walmart, those kinds of things. And they have got data points, huge numbers of data points on all their shoppers, because what you buy is, to an extent, what you are if you're shopping in a shop as big as that. And this was a story about it's partly centres on a man called Andrew Pohl. And he created a model for Target to predict when women were pregnant. And it worked on how much of unscented lotion they bought and the size of bags they bought and things like this. There were a bunch of markers that showed that you were 10 weeks pregnant, 20 weeks pregnant, and targeted you with leaflets or emails accordingly. About a year after Pohl created his pregnancy prediction model, a man walked into a Target outside Minneapolis and demanded to see the manager. He was clutching coupons that had been sent to his daughter, and he was angry, according to an employee who participated in the conversation. "My daughter got this in the mail," he said. "She's still in high school, and you're sending her coupons for baby clothes and cribs. Are you trying to encourage her to get pregnant?" The manager had no idea what the man was talking about. He looked at the mailer. Sure enough, it was addressed to the man's daughter and contained advertisements for maternity clothing, nursery furniture, and pictures of smiling infants. The manager apologised and then called a few days later to apologise again. On the phone, though, the father was somewhat abashed. "I had a talk with my daughter," he said. It turns out there's been some activities in my house I haven't been completely aware of. She's due in August. I owe you an apology.
So the date knew more than the father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The shop's computers knew more than the father. Yeah. And that's just from using your credit card, swiping your frequent flyers card, whatever. Yeah. Facebook knows much more about you than that. And there is a firm called Cambridge Analytica, which has been credited with having had a huge influence on both the Brexit votes and on the Trump vote. There's a lot of debate in the computer community about whether they really did or whether they're just hyping themselves. Mm-hmm. But clearly, there are people out there in the corporate sector and in the political sector, potentially, who do know a hell of a lot about us. How is that going to impact on democracy?
So this idea that you can ruthlessly target political messages to any individual on Facebook just from their behaviour on Facebook. And according to Cambridge Analytica, they know more... I think it's not... I forget the figures, but there's after a certain number of likes, they know more about what you're going to do than you do. They may have very good spin docs, as we all read that piece, and it's been discredited since. But just an interesting fact that Steve Bannon was one of the big investors and was
and
on the board
Koch
of
brothers.
The Koch brothers. The problem with it is well, there's many problems, but nobody can see it. It's no like we critique political advertising, we can critique political spending and political money.
Policies.
And we can critique policies, but we don't know when people are getting messages that are just targeted to them, that are different, that each of us would get different ones. We don't know if they've got truths in them or what's in them. And we don't know what's in them. But they claim great effectiveness in both Brexit and Trump. It's a very sinister development and very unsettling, I think.
But almost by definition, it also mitigates against a proper, factual, thought-through political platform, because if you're trying to say different things, it's not just spinning something slightly different in the country or the city or the things that we're used to. It's probably part of the reason why Trump's platform was so completely incoherent. I mean, if you had a enunciated, clear set of policy pronouncements, that it would be difficult to then say entirely different things to different people. But if you don't tie yourself down to anything like that, then that strategy can work. So it really, it undermines what politics was supposed to be about.
But it also undermines the very idea of a public sphere. I mean, this is all, it's in millions and billions of tiny individual spheres. The whole idea of public space, which is such an important liberal and progressive idea.
Absolutely.
It takes me back to that article, another New York Times article back in 2003 by Ron Susskind, which is a fairly famous article now, where he quoted an official who's now known to have been Karl Rove, who said to Susskind, you and you generally in the media, you live in the reality-based community. And you're welcome to it, because that's not where we need to live anymore. We create our own reality. Mm. This was in the lead-up to the Iraq War, of course. And at the time, it seemed arrogant, possibly hubristic, but it increasingly looks less and less like science fiction and more like reality.
Yep.
So why are we here?
Why are we still here?
Yeah, why are we all here asserting that that facts matter and that journalism matters and that we still have a role to play?
Well, it's possibly it doesn't. Possibly it won't.
Probably
I think we've got to fight. We are the resistance. I think we have to fight for that. Otherwise, everything falls apart. Don't you think?
Yep.
But I think so.
Yep.
I mean, you spend 4 decades in journalism, as I have, and all you have to hang your hat on is the idea of truth. And you referred to it, but and I've never been very enamoured of the whole postmodern thesis that there's no such thing as truth. I've never held to the idea that there's an absolute truth. I think there is a sort of Rashomon effect, you know, everybody sees something different. But our job is to go around the witnesses and get as many accounts of it as we can. Carl Bernstein talks about it as the best obtainable version of the truth, and I think that's pretty good. Yeah. But, you know, are we going to be in the next... let's say, is what happened in Brexit and what happened with Trump going to create a backlash so that people actually come looking for facts and truth again? Or is it going to slide further? Because there are different, there's different evidence about that in terms of subscriptions and so forth.
Yes. Lots of people taking out subscriptions to fact-based, serious news organisations and membership. I think we shouldn't panic. This is all the fallout of the technological revolution. You know, we had the first decade of that sort of utopian, this is a beautiful flowering of voices and everyone can publish and it's going to be fabulous. And
that was the summer of love and this is Altamont.
Yeah. And we just need to come out the other side, you know, and I think the challenge is to sort of stay true to good fact-based information, not be swayed, and until the good times come again.
I also think a little part of the answer is to not be constantly distracted by what people claim, by what politicians say, but to always come back to what is actually happening, what is the impact of what they're doing, what's happening on the ground, what are the results. So if you look to America, and I may be proved wrong here, but if we are constantly talking about trying to fact check what Donald Trump is saying, that's one thing. But if you go to the states of America that supported Donald Trump because they thought that he would make their lives materially better and report and look at whether that's in fact happening, then I think it's easier to nail down truth in the lived experience of people's lives than in the claims that politicians make.
Are we getting towards the time when we can take questions? Let me ask you both a final question before we get questions from the audience. There have been suggestions that, for instance, it should be built into the education system, that kids, high school kids particularly, should be taught more about how to distinguish between real news and fake news. An answer from both of you about what advice you would give people in distinguishing fake news from real news.
I think you have to be careful about fake news. Like, fake news is the entirely manufactured... It's not just bad journalism. It's the farmed, utterly fictional journalism. And I think we can't be sucked into the politicians who want to redefine fake news as something
else. Let's take it back into Aussie idiom and just call it what we used to call it, which is massive beta.
Right.
So ratchet journalism.
Yeah.
Yeah. BS.
What's your advice? You know, what's your checklist for what's a massive beat up?
Well, you need to look at whether there's different sides of a story. If it's a news story, you need to look if there's quotes and sort of verifiable information. You need to, you know, the sort of things that you look for to see if an article is. It can be proven to be true.
And the source.
Yeah, sourcing.
Learning about sources and how, as in the news organisation, and how they're funded, who pays for them, who benefits from them, which is, you know, why everyone needs to be owned by a trust like The Guardian, where nobody gets rich and nobody can have commercial or political interference.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
So I think there are a couple of microphones out there.
Yeah, if
somebody
would
like to. I've got some cards coming to me. Here's a question on a card. As a business that makes income via advertising primarily, how do you balance what's popular with what's important?
Well, the thing that I think's most heartening is that most important is often what's most popular on The Guardian. Obviously, that's not always the case. Sometimes it will be a kind of surprising sports victory or something more entertaining. But it's just very heartening that the very, very serious stories often do really well, thoughtful analysis and big news stories. It really is. I mean, you know, Trump is 18 out of our top 20 most read some days. And, you know, all of our reporting on Trump is really serious and well-sourced. We've got a really fantastic and pretty big team of reporters in the US doing that. So it's surprising, but it's true.
Yeah, and one of the great things about the membership strategy is that it actually rewards us. It's good for us to write more and more and more of the sorts of stories that our readers most want to read. So it means that it's quite aligned with...
Is there any danger there of creating a new bubble?
There's a danger, yes.
Well, there is obviously a Guardian bubble. It's the best bubble to be in. But it's... So we've got this series at the moment that's by Jason Wilson, Australian writer who's based in Oregon, that's called Burst Your Bubble. And you can read that every week, and he gives some really good... thoughtful, you know, good quality conservative sources, stories to read. The point being, you know, this sort of thing that, you know, Fox News isn't terrible because it's conservative. Fox News is terrible because it's dishonest. And so he gives you interesting sources that are conservative and honest.
He did some great reporting out of Oregon on those extraordinary people who tried to set up their own sort of mini nation.
Amazing,
didn't he?
Yeah.
I wish this was a little bit more specific, but Lenore, if many lobby and support groups are happy to reject reality by constructing their own truths, what's the point of challenging them with facts? Is that something that you're familiar with?
Well, I think there's always got... I think we've got to hold on to facts, because if we don't, then the whole basis, the whole sort of guide rails for democracy are gone. It's increasingly challenging to make sure that facts penetrate, which is what we've been talking about, but I don't think we can give up on it. We've got to find ways of doing it. And what I was saying before is I think part of it is going into people's real lived experience, because that's something that's very hard to deny. You can deny an idea if you don't like it, but if there's a lived... So, I mean, for example, I think part of the reason that the proportion of the population that accepts the idea of human-induced climate change has grown is because of the lived experience of an increased frequency of extreme weather events. It's hard to actually, you know, exist in the world and not see that something is changing with the climate. It's very difficult to hold on to... you know, a fiction, an untruth, when what you're seeing in front of you doesn't back it up. So,
and yet, Corey Bernardi.
Well, if you can explain Corey Bernardi.
But that was shorthand, and yet you have to deal with quite a number of people.
Well, and members of the cabinet, of course.
Some of whom overtly and some of whom much less openly in the parliament. Deny climate change or anthropogenic climate change.
Yes, that is true. But I think compared to when this debate started, like when we really started to have this debate at the forefront of politics, and now it's harder for anyone to be avowedly climate sceptic. So now the climate sceptics hide behind the complexity of the issues. They will say, you know, that there is a clean way of using coal, but they can't just sort of come out and say we should just keep using coal because climate science is, you know, a socialist plot dreamed up by China, actually. wait a minute. No, but, you know, in our debate, avowed open climate scepticism isn't really a position that you could win a majority of the population with. It's got to be hidden behind other arguments, I think. And I think that's because of the lived experience that fewer people can, you know, can actually deny it, even if they wished it wasn't true.
Kath, when you went back to London, was it a relief to be in a political community that had much more broadly accepted climate change for a decade?
Well, unfortunately, after I left Sydney, I moved to America, so that was definitely not the case. Yes, I mean, it's, you know, we have our own battles on that front around fracking and so on, but it's not really as much about denial, although some denialists are, you know, have a loud voice.
How can and does The Guardian deal effectively with the organised and politicised astroturfing existing in the comments section? And in case anybody doesn't know what astroturfing is, it's a... it covers the idea that people who, yeah, they may have a vested interest in one thing or another, come up as trying to look like genuine commenters. I think that's fair to say that's what astroturfing is. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, often from a kind of political...
Generally and in Australia, generally first.
Well, I think we have this very... really excellent team of moderators who are sort of trained to spot when that's happening. Often it'll come in a swarm, generally not one individual. And, you know, they're trained to spot it. They're trained to see how people register their IP addresses, whether they've come back before, whether it can be banned again. And we've also got a machine now who helps us do some of that. They say, Have you noticed this?
What is it, without giving away trade secrets is it looking for particular keywords?
Sort of language patterns or lots language of people patterns. Saying the same thing or repetition and so on, yeah.
Right. Lenore?
Well, yes, so we have moderators. Actually, some of our commenters are quite good at calling out other commenters.
Yes, yeah.
And we've just started this system where editors will sort of pick the comments that they think are most constructive and useful in a discussion under a story, and then those ones are then at the top of the comment section, and it means when you first sort of look under an article, that's what you see, and that tends to sort of push the commenting thread into a more productive kind of conversation. Sometimes if it's a story that I've written, one of my columns, and I can see the thread sort of veering off into a not very good conversation, I can dive in and, you know, just enter into the argument in a civilised way, and it kind of can sometimes bring that discussion back to, you know, a civilised disagreement. So there's different ways to sort of tackle that problem.
Do you, that's really interesting because I other than blocking and muting on Twitter, I don't use a lot of strategies. I mean, this is Twitter being a similar kind of forum in terms of what you get back. And I tend to find that my feed is relatively civilized. I don't block a lot. And I try to when I reply to people, I try to reply civilly. I sort of use an old ABC rule, that was developed for answering telephones, and basically it's that you're supposed to be polite and engage up to a certain point, but if people swear at you or abuse you or whatever, you're perfectly entitled to hang up. Although that does, there is a great story about that. Now that Peter Cave is retired, I can tell you this story. He answered the phone one night, and there was an absolute tirade of abuse about the program. It may even have been a story about a story that he did, but he listened for a while, and he said in a very outraged voice, "Do you know who I am?" And the person said, "No." He said, "Good, fuck off." You can't do that in the comments section.
You can't.
That might be useful at some point, mightn't it? I mean, if I could just add a point to that, you know, I think sort of the technique of treating, of having a sort of engaged conversation, as Lorne was saying, as you were saying, works up to a point. Yeah. But there's a point where, you know, we did some research last year with the only news organisation to do it, which was to examine all the comments ever left on The Guardian ever since we opened them up. I forget, it was 7 million comments, I think.
Whoa.
2 million? A lot. Facts matter.
11 billion.
And what we discovered, so we were trying to see who were the most abused of our writers. And of the 10 most abused writers, 8 were women.
Yeah.
And the other 2 were black men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's on The Guardian, you know, I mean...
Yeah. No, that's a fair point. I mean, I would concede straight away that, being a privileged white male gives me a different perspective. While the right has been so successful in grasping the zeitgeist, why has the left failed to offer a strong counter-movement?
Where's the leadership on the left? It's a good question. It's a problem all around the world. Yeah, good question.
I don't have a formulated answer to it, but I think part of it is that the left sort of moved to the centre when the centre was the very contested part of political ground. And the interesting thing has been the success of people like Jeremy Corbyn or Bernie Sanders. So maybe, you know, the left has to reconsider what the solutions are for the sort of economic discontent that is leading to the fracturing of politics, and how to articulate them and how to actually look different from the very anodyne centrist political debate that we've been having for a really long time, and that isn't getting us very far.
And that the sort of triangulation of those years meant that politicians of the liberal left became distant from ordinary people's lives. Mm. They came quite separate, technocratic, talking in language that was hard to follow, and just became adrift from the people who might elect them. You know, in Britain, lots of MPs with no connection whatsoever to working class communities from in very, very different backgrounds would be swooped in to represent them as MPs. And it's the sort of insult of that. I think we're paying the price for that.
And I think on both sides of politics too, there is the detachment from reality that when I entered journalism, politicians mostly had done something else in their lives other than politics beforehand. And now there's just a procession of people who start at university and then become aides to politicians and maybe start in state parliament, get themselves a state MP job, or become a political advisor in Parliament House in Canberra, and so on. And so there is a great perception out there, and it's not unreal, that these are people who don't really have much to do
with
the
rest of us. Which comes down to the role of political parties as institutions that aren't really shifting with the times. So, you know, it's the parties that are responsible for those pre-selections that are sort of institutions for preferment and career advancement. And I think increasingly those institutions are being found wanting, and they're suffering the price by the splintering of the vote.
Yeah. We might take another question from the audience if somebody wants to grab a microphone. While we're waiting, I've got another sort of slightly technical question about how all this is managed. I think I read last year that Google did a bit of an adjustment to its algorithm, and which instead of really concentrating on individual clicks, started looking much more at how far people went into an article. And you see this on quite a lot of news sites now, where it just asks you continue reading. In other words, after about four paragraphs, are you still interested in this story? So they're obviously trying to collect that metric as well. Are you collecting that, and has that changed things for you, and do people want to read long-form journalism?
Yes, it's one of the main metrics we collect, particularly since we're sort of, you know, the scale model for journalism isn't working, and we, you know, the Guardian publishes really a lot of in-depth, thoughtful stuff. You know, it really does. So yes, attention time is as much competed for as traffic now, and again, that can be not necessarily the most obvious things. It can be. It's nearly always heartening what people spend a lot of time reading or watching. We had put up the whole of that 90-minute Donald Trump press conference, and so many people watched it all the way to the end.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Yeah, they are just in horrified fascination, I think. Yeah.
But it's also a lesson, right? Like when you get that metric if you're a reporter and it says, you know, your article had X number of words, it would take 3 minutes to read. The average attention time was, you know, 24 seconds. It's telling you something. You know, if that's what happens,
Write it shorter.
You haven't kept them.
Write it shorter or write it better.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Put more individual stories into it or whatever. Yes.
But people do read long.
I agree with you about the necessity to tell individual people's stories and family stories.
People do read long form, and they read them on their mobiles. We have this slot called the Long Read, which is a 5,000 word in depth article. We do three a week, and people read them on their mobiles. You know, they really do. And I find that I actually prefer to read long articles on my phone than on a desktop. Personally, it works really
well.
It's
very heartening. That is the one of the heartening trends, and that was just from one little adjustment on the Google algorithm, I think.
Sorry, we just have a question at the back.
How do you deal with the truth when you can't get at it? So does the truth matter in On Water Matters, for instance?
Oh, yeah, good question.
Yes, of course, and that's our job, and sometimes our job is really difficult and sometimes we can only do it imperfectly, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try with everything we've got because it's important.
But it's also dangerous. I mean, the ABC reported a story and we've been under attack from it and are still under attack from people at The Australian, must be a year and a half later or whatever, about the refugees being picked up by a Navy ship and getting burnt and injured. And you try, again, it's the best obtainable version of the truth. You try to put out what you know at the time, but have you got enough sources? You know, I think going back to the how you know what is and isn't fake news or massive beat-up, there's a great line in American journalism. If your mother tells you she loves you, check. that's our responsibility. Always that is our responsibility. We have to go on checking until you get it right. And sometimes you're going to say things that aren't 100% right to start off with. We are in a much more dangerous news cycle now because it's not a 24-hour news cycle anymore. It's a 24-second news cycle. And there are these constant pressures. And one word, in an intro, out of place, can really bugger you up. Mm. In organisations that profess to be responsible, such as ours, all you can do is just keep checking.
And then be very open and honest when you make mistakes and why they happened and explain what went wrong and how you plan to try and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, and then write another story which gets closer to the best obtainable version.
And go for different ways of finding the truth. So as well as On Water Matters, obviously the offshore processing centres are very difficult places to report on because we can't go there. But, I mean, Guardian Australia got the Nauru files. Now, that's a different way of illustrating what happened there through a different set of facts and data, but it told a really powerful story. So, I mean, I think it's just looking at however you can get at illuminating something, even if all the laws of the land are trying to prevent you from finding out about it.
Okay, well, we're just over our time, so... But I think the questions have been great.
Fantastic.
And thank you very much, everybody, whether you wrote them on a card or said them through a microphone.
And I would just like to thank you all very much for coming. Thank you for your interest in The Guardian and in Guardian Australia. I'd like to thank Catherine Viner for giving up her time and talking to us tonight. And I'd really like to thank Mark Colvin for scooting over from PM so quickly and giving us all of his wisdom as well. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Lines. If you're an existing member, we'd love to hear from you. Email australia.membership@theguardian.com to say hello or to give us some feedback. If you'd like to become a Guardian member and support our independent journalism, go to theguardian.com/AU. For more conversations with our columnists, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. Please don't forget to leave a rating or review. It helps other people find the podcast.